Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, my name is Kevin Tilsner. This is Caution Tinfoil Hat Area. I'm also known as Karma Tinfoil on Facebook. This is call ID number 89564 on Talk Shoe. Welcome, everyone, and also a huge welcome to both of my special guests today, Mr. Derek Jensen, sir. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And I also have on the line Charlie Veach of the Love Police.
Hi, Karma. How you doing?
Very good. It's really great to actually hear you guys. I have one quick announcement for tomorrow here in Philly. On Wednesday, June 29th, from 7 to 9, Mike Salvi will be speaking at McAllister Hall, 33rd and Chestnut Street in Philadelphia, PA. There's a Facebook invitation by the Student Liberty Front online. Please check that out. It's SLF Mike Salvi on What's Next, the Future of Economics. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your patience, and wow, thank you for like coming on. This is like a really big moment for me because you guys have both been, I would go so far as to say, huge inspirations of mine over the last 3 years, respectively, for Derek, and about a year and a half now for Charlie. Both of you guys have done some amazing research and amazing work, Charlie online, and Derek, your books are at this point world renowned by a lot of people. Really are picking up the message of the fact that we're, as you put it in one of your lectures, we're fucked. Like we're in a really bad way, and like people finally are starting to get it and are slowly but surely waking up to these ideas that you've presented. How does it feel to kind of see that starting to grow and that really actually starting to expand, even if just a little bit at start?
Well, I suppose that's good to have that additional recognition, but it's at best bittersweet because the recognition isn't coming because of any happy things. The recognition is coming because more and more people are recognizing that the world is being killed. And I did a talk in Galesburg, Illinois, mid-May, and my flight in was pretty late. And I got into this small-town airport, Moline, Illinois, about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm standing out in front waiting for my shuttle to the hotel, and I can't figure out, there's something wrong, and I can't figure out what it is for maybe 5 minutes until I realize that even though there's all these, parking lots with the parking lot lights and the airport itself, that I didn't see a single moth, and it's bad. And then I got to the hotel, and I did the prototypical tour experience, which is, get into a hotel at 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and then take a walk to the, half mile to a local Denny's. I guess they're not local, to a 24-hour restaurant. And I had to walk across a river and past a pond and past a bunch of swampy areas. And this is mid-May, and I didn't hear a single frog. And that's really bad. And here, at home in Northern California, I used to, all through the summer, I would probably carry out one or two crane flies every day or every evening who would come in. And I think I've carried out three or four the whole year. Everybody is going fast. I was just talking to or emailing, communicating with a friend of mine in works for the Park Service in Carlsbad, New Mexico, whose husband has been studying the cave swallows for 20 years. And the cave swallows are having reproductive failure this year because there aren't any insects. And they what they do is they put nets across certain parts where they're flying in. They capture a certain percentage of swallows when they fly in, and will weigh them, and they're all weighing less, and then they will also see if they have an insect in their mouth. And 0% have insects in their mouth this spring when they're flying in. That means there's no babies inside. So yeah, things are, and it's also becoming increasingly obvious that, you know, the culture is insane, and that we don't live in a democracy. And I'm glad that people are having the recognition, but part of the reason that they're having the recognition is because things are so obvious. You know, when they're trying to frack the water supply of New York City, I mean, they're not just fracking the colonies, they're destroying their own water supply too. It's all pretty extraordinary.
They're doing that here in Philadelphia, actually. They're passing legislation to get it started out in the Delaware River. So I understand how this has been very distressing on a lot of people, that idea of like fracking. It's not something that's really good for the environment in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And one of the things that people seem to forget so often is that without a real world, you don't live. And they forget that the real world is primary, that what you need to survive is water, food, clean water, non-poisonous water, water that doesn't ignite when you set a match to it, and clean food. And those are the basics, and air. And the system itself is, of course, toxic and requires the destruction of land bases. I mean, that's what it's been doing for the last 6,000 years. And we're really in the end game of all of it.
I know you're...
I was going to ask,
like, I remember your talk specifically and the whole bashing hope speech that you did, and I understand that in a lot of ways. And it really took me a long time to even get through all of the conspiracy stuff and all of the different levels of corruption and seeing that our entire society is aberrated, that I was finally like, I forget this. If anyone doesn't understand that our world is really messed up at this point, they've kind of lost their own mind, and we really need to start focusing on sharing solutions. And I one of the things I always like to do is have each guest on specifically to have a moment on my little soapbox to actually offer some of their best solutions that they think are really some of the things that we could really do to affect change immediately.
Well, I think that we need to put our bodies in between the oil economy and life on the planet. The way that I think really helps to look at this is to ask ourselves what we would do if space aliens had come down from outer space and they were systematically vacuuming the oceans and they were deforesting the planet and they were putting docks in every mother's breast milk and they were changing the climate and they were causing the greatest mass extinction in the history of the planet. If aliens came down and they were fracking the water supply, and they were putting dams on every river, and they were doing all of this absolutely crazy stuff, I think that we would develop a resistance movement that would act decisively to destroy the aliens' ability to wage war. And the way you win wars, I mean, if we learn nothing else from the American Civil War and from World War II, we should learn that the way you win a war is by destroying the industrial base or the transportation base and or the transportation base of the enemy. And so I think we need to have a serious resistance movement that will act to save the planet, that will act to make capitalism increasingly ungovernable. I mean, it's pretty damn funny, actually, that Bernie Madoff has accomplished more a few years ago than basically three quarters of environmentalists put together by helping to crash the economy. Amazon deforestation was the lowest in 2008-2009, was the lowest it had been since they started recording. And it was because of the economy. It wasn't because of environmental concerns. And the rates of carbon emissions actually went up less than it had in other years because of the slowing of the economy. And that's a lesson right there for how you bring about lasting environmental change is by stopping the system. I mean, here's another way to look at this, is that there's a great book by Robert J. Lifton called The Nazi Doctors, and in this book he asked how it was that men who had taken a Hippocratic Oath could go and work in Nazi death camps. And what he found is that many of the doctors actually cared very deeply for the health of the inmates, and they would do whatever they could to help the inmates. They would, if they were in pain, they would give them an aspirin to lick, or they would hide them from the selection office who were going to kill them, or they would put them to bed for a day or two, or they would give them an extra scrap of potato. They would do everything they could except for the most important thing of all, which is they wouldn't question the existence of the death camp itself. They wouldn't question working the slaves to death. They wouldn't question starving them to death. They wouldn't question gassing them to death. And environmentalists, we generally do the same thing, which is so many environmentalists I know, myself included, doing everything we can to try to protect this or that species, this or that piece of ground. And we're doing everything we can except for the most important thing of all, which is we aren't questioning this entire culture that's turning the whole world into first a work camp and then a death camp. And that is working the planet to death, that's starving to death, it's gassing it to death. And you can't make a nice, friendly, eco-green, sustainable death camp. It's still a death camp. And this culture has been based on slavery from the beginning. And, of course, when I tell this to indigenous people, they're like, yeah, tell us something we don't know. And the point is that we need to destroy the system, and we need to destroy – I'm not talking about this on a purely intellectual or emotional level. Yes, it's very important for us to decolonize our hearts and minds and for us to see the system for what it is. But the important thing – but me writing books, me helping people to get out of abusive relationships, me helping people to decolonize doesn't do a damn thing for the salmon. That's why in one of my books, one of my most famous lines is, every morning when I get up, I ask myself whether I should write or blow up a dam. And what that question's really getting at is the difference between symbolic and non-symbolic resistance. And people forget that the point is not to have a really great demonstration, and the point is not to write a really great book or have a really great interview or do a really great podcast or radio show or anything else. The point is none of those things. The point is to help save the salmon. The point is to change the conditions in the real physical world. And to do that, the point of doing all this writing is to help build a resistance movement that will bring down civilization, that will stop civilization from killing what's left of the planet. And what that means is destroying the economy. And it means taking on the industrial infrastructure. And I know it's daunting, but once again, if we were talking about space aliens, these would be straightforward technical questions. The hard part is the first part, which is breaking your identity with the system. And a joke I like to tell about this is that a friend called me up and says, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? I looked around and was like, I didn't even know we're in Iraq. I thought we were in Northern California. I was like, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? I was like, I got troops? Will they do what I tell them? And my friend said, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks. And the point is that we hear this all the time. We torture. We deforest. It's like, I didn't do it, and I need to break my identity with the system. And a great example of this is after Fukushima, George Monbiot said that But he still thinks nuclear is absolutely essential, nuclear energy. And part of the reason he thinks it's absolutely essential is because he said basically, how else are we going to get the energy that we need to run the blast furnaces and the brick kilns and the other factories? And let's change a couple words on that. How else are the capitalists going to get the electricity that they need to run their factories, their brick kilns? Because they're not mine, and I need to not identify with the system. Once we break identity with the system, everything else becomes technical. And that doesn't mean it's not daunting, but it's not. But it becomes more straightforward. Because when people ask, how can we stop global warming, they're not really asking how can we stop global warming. What they're asking is, how can we stop global warming without stopping the oil economy? And the answer is you can't. So how do we stop global warming? Pretty straightforward. You stop the burning of oil and gas by using whatever means are necessary. And how do you save salmon? Well, when people ask that, they're asking how we can save salmon without removing dams, without stopping industrial agriculture, without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, et cetera, et cetera. The answer is you can't. I'll say one more thing about this, which is the they say one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. I'm going to lay out a pattern. Let's see if we can recognize in less than 6,000 years, which is when you think of Iraq, is the first thing you think of is cedar forest so thick the sunlight never touches the ground? That's what it was prior to the beginnings of this culture. One of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq in order to make cities. And the Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. Italy was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. Britain was heavily forested. And that's what this culture does. There's a great line by Tecumseh's brother, Chiksika, Shani. He said that the whole white race is a monster, and what it eats is land. And this culture has been devouring land for 6 or 10,000 years. And this is what happens when you devour land, is you destroy it. And if we care about life on the planet, we need to stop it.
Do things like, I don't know. I don't know what direction you may research, but like my wife specifically this morning mentioned to me about how they found a way to do very I'm almost afraid to ask you this question because I think I know where you may go with it, but I'm going to just mention this anyway and just see what you have to say about it. She was talking about how they actually found a way to go into various older areas and do kind of like very specific versions of logging where they would actually take out older trees that would actually not only generate them more wood, but it would also specifically help that area grow new trees as well, because once that one large tree was taken out, they could plant like 10 new ones into that zone. And then there's also like a gentleman by the name of Paul Stemmitz. He had a TED talk that was about six ways mushrooms can save the world. And one of them was actually, he literally found a type of mushroom that was able to like help reproduce old growth forests. And I was wondering if you'd heard about any of these types of things.
Well, a couple things. The first one is, it's absurd to one of the ways that the timber industry one of the misleading statements that they make is that there are more trees now in the United States than there were 500 years ago. Well, that might be true if you count a seedling as the same as a 500-year or 2,000-year-old tree. And what's the point of cutting down a 2,000-year-old tree except to make money and replacing it with tiny trees? Because the huge trees are natural communities all their own. There are newts and salamanders and marble murrelets who live in the crowns of ancient redwoods, and they don't live elsewhere. And that's their home. And a community a forest community includes young trees, old trees, mushrooms. It includes a mosaic of ages and dead trees. Dead standing trees are in many ways more important to the forest than live standing trees. I've been thinking about this a lot as I walk through the forest right here, that this forest is probably about 50, 60 years old, and it's actually doing pretty well. But as I walk around, I notice that there are almost no standing dead trees. The standing dead trees are the homes for birds. I mean, that's where they make their homes, is the wood becomes soft, and they can make a hole and build their home inside of it. And a dead standing tree is called a snag. And like I said, those are even more important to the forest than a young tree. And another way to talk about this is that Weyerhaeuser, for example, puts their Douglas firs on a rotation of 50 years. And that means the average age of any Douglas fir that they're growing is 26 years. Well, Doug firs don't really reach full maturity until 300 years, which means there are almost no adult Doug firs in the West and in the U.S. here. And that's, adult Doug firs are homes for different creatures than young Doug firs. And so far as Paul Stamets, yeah, he does really great work. And, you know, I've talked to him, and he's told me some amazing things about mushrooms. There are mushrooms who are eating the radioactivity inside of Chernobyl, inside the actual reactor. And there are mushrooms who can clean up oil messes. They eat the oil, and oyster mushrooms do that. And there's mushrooms do help to oversee the life of a forest. They will take nutrients from trees that get a lot of sun, and they will give it to trees who are in shade to help them grow. They're quite extraordinary beings. But that doesn't alter the fact that no mushroom can turn a seedling into a 500-year-old tree. There was a pretty interesting article written about 15, 20 years ago by Chris Mazur about, what was it called? He used the word pooperoonies in the title. And basically it was that if you replant Doug firs, I believe it was, on a clear cut, they won't grow. And the reason is because they need certain fungi in their roots to help them metabolize. This is pretty common, you know. Plants will have humans have these entire communities living inside of us, and plants are the same with their roots and everything else. But it doesn't, the plant itself can't live on its own. It needs bacteria, it needs fungi, etc. Anyway, the point is that voles and flying squirrels will eat this certain type of fungus, and then they'll poop it out, and then the Doug fir root tips will reach out to the, what Chris Mazur called the pooperoonies, will reach out to the little poop pellets, and then they will get inoculated with the fungus, which then helps them to eat, and they can grow much better when they're inoculated. I mean, that's part of how a forest community works. But a fungus by itself is not going to make old growth forest. You can't artificially, a 10-year-old tree is not the same as a 300-year-old tree any more than a 6-week-old baby is the same as a 70-year-old person. And one tree doesn't make an old-growth forest anyway. I mean, it's the entire community. So there's sort of my response to those.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, because I had a feeling that would be where you would go with it, but I just really wanted to draw that out of you, just specifically for my wife's sake, because we'd had a lot of conversations along those lines, and I know she had definitely wanted to hear your take on that concept. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. I think I'd like to actually bring on Mr. Charles Veach here at this point, and allow him to have some time with you as well, since I'm one of my great joys in life is to be able to connect different people who are activists, and not just connect with them, but get them connected. And he's read your book Endgame at minimum. I'm not sure what else, but I know he's spoken about that a couple times in a few of his YouTube videos. And yeah, from London, this is Charlie Veach. How you doing, man?
Hey guys. Hey Derek. Hey Kevin.
Hey.
Yeah, I've got a lot of things to say, and it's been very interesting listening. And Derek, it's an absolute pleasure to be able to speak to you from the other side of the pond, as they say. I just want to say a few things as a guest, as kind of praise, but very kind of equal praise, non-hierarchy anarchist praise, that your book, Endgame, spawned a series of talks I'm doing at a bunch of festivals across Britain. And that talk is called Firebombing McDonald's, Different Approaches to Revolution. And there's two particular premises which I want to read out from your book, Endgame, which I think are very pertinent here and very quick, so they won't take too long. And also very esoteric numbers, 11 and 13. Premise 11, from the beginning, this culture, civilization, has been a culture of occupation. And what you were saying about Iraq, about how there were cedar woods so thick that you couldn't see the ground is absolutely correct. Our civilization, give or take 1,000 years or so, is what, 7,000 years old? And for the other 250,000 years of human experience, we were living in harmony with nature, living on the land, according to the land, almost in tune with nature. And there's also premise 13, which is the one I'm particularly interested in as an activist, and it's why I do what I do. Those in power rule by force, and the sooner we break ourselves of illusions to the contrary, the sooner we can at least begin to make reasonable decisions about whether, when, and how we are going to resist. Also, you mentioned in your book, Derek, that you said you felt ashamed at times, you felt cowardly that all you're doing is writing. Well, I guess I am also a coward with you. I make films. I guess what I'm trying to say is don't put yourself down, because by writing Endgame, and I truly honestly believe this is one of the most honest books that I've ever read, because and you say that all writers are propagandists, but your propaganda does appeal to reason, it appeals to fact, and I love the way that you don't hide. You clearly present it to the table how your experiences with your parents, in particular your father, has helped shape your worldview about abuse and people in abusive relationships. And also, I'm good friends with a guy called Stefan Molyneux, who has the biggest biggest philosophy podcast in the world. And he's watched by tens of millions of people. And he says that our relationship to our parents, our residual relationship to our parents, is a kind of mimicry of our relationship to government. So I can see how your experiences have basically made you very wary of, and quite rightly so, very wary of hierarchy and wary of government and wary of power. Another thing as well, you guys talked about in the last half hour about how we can actually, what are the first steps we can do to save the world? Well, I think there's some very simple things people can do. It's like, don't have a car. I'm going to be 31 in August, and I've never owned a car. And I think, as you say, yeah, we need to decolonize hearts and minds, because if we look at the example of the Weather Underground, the kind of anarchist resistance group in America, and was it the 60s, 70s? I forget the decade, but they started a campaign of selective targeting of military and capitalist institutions, and for some reason, that didn't actually catch on amongst the general anti-war, anti-capitalist, anti-system population. They were somehow put off by the violence, which in a way is very interesting as an anthropologist, as someone who would like to see a return to resistance. So I guess what I do in my work with my films and my work in trying to inspire people is to try to get people to wake the fuck up and to start realizing that they are powerful. And I think the only change we can see is the change that we try and instill in other people. If you've seen the film Inception, the whole film is about planting a seed in someone's mind to the point where he thinks that he had that original idea himself. So, no, I could go on, Derek, for an hour about how much I enjoyed your book. And I guess, for me, I resonate very strongly with many of your ideas about direct resistance. But my first question to you, Derek, is, is how do we avoid the fizzling out of any kind of, say, organized and direct resistance to the machine? How do we stop that fizzling out in the mainstream, main narrative of propaganda by the mainstream media, just instantly labeling us terrorists and idiots?
Well, thanks for saying all that. And I think that we have to recognize that the mainstream media will never be on our side. There's a great line by Henry Adams. He lived maybe 100 and some years ago. He said, "The press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other purpose than to tell lies where the interests are concerned." I'll say it again. "The press is the hired agent of a moneyed system set up for no other reason than to tell lies where the interests are concerned." And I used to worry a bit more about being labeled an extremist or whatever until I saw this op-ed piece in the San Francisco Chronicle in which they were labeling an insect a terrorist. And it's called a glassy-winged sharpshooter, and has nothing to do with guns or anything. Let's just name the insect, glassy-winged sharpshooter. And it can carry a disease that can infect grapevines and can affect the wine industry. And so the point is that if in the newspaper they're going to call an insect a terrorist, then the word's pretty meaningless in terms of those in power are going to label anybody who opposes them a terrorist or Emmanuel Goldstein, or they're gonna make up enemies and make up names for those enemies. And this also happens on the individual level all the time. That I'm sure you've, well, I don't know if you have, but I know I've been in abusive relationships before where if I ask, even if I ask politely, if I ask, politely ask the abuser to stop, calling me names or something, then I suddenly am the one who is victimizing them. And that's just a standard tactic of abusers, whether we're talking about the personal or social scale. Hitler said that Poland attacked. That's why Germany had to defend itself by going after Poland. It's just really, of course, the United States had to invade Iraq because Iraq was, this close, just 2 seconds from invading the U.S. or from doing God knows what to the U.S. I mean, that's just standard to declare that you're the victim when you're actually the perp. So I'm not so worried about that, except that doesn't alter the fact that we should we shouldn't give them additional ammunition to use in their propaganda. And a great example of this is, I don't remember the name of it right now, but there was an IRA bombing in where they bombed, I believe it was a memorial service for the widows of war veterans. And it's like, that was a terrible, terrible, well, first off, it was an atrocity. And second, it was a terrible propaganda problem for the IRA and Sinn Féin. And it took years to recover from doing this action that was both an atrocity and very poorly thought out. I mean, that's not your enemy. Your enemy is not widows. And so the first part is that we need to not really worry about how we get labeled. And at the same time, I mean, for God's sake, here in California, there were some people arrested for terrorism under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act maybe 4 or 5 years ago, because they were chalking messages, weren't even threatening messages. They were chalking, "You're a vivisector, you're a killer," on the sidewalk in front of a vivisector's house. And for that they were charged with terrorism. You know, I would have no problem in that case with them having been arrested with for harassment or, you know, whatever. If you're going to have, I mean, if they're going to be arrested for something, it's like, yeah, harassment's what they get. But instead, they actually charge them with terrorism for writing messages in chalk on the, and they, once again, they weren't even threatening messages. So it's just extraordinary that you'll be labeled. I mean, it's not extraordinary. It's where it's 1984, you know, but you'll be a terrorist if you oppose capitalism in any way. So once you have once you've accepted that you're going to be called a terrorist anyway, it's like, okay, let's just go from there. And then after that, you can be smart and not do things that will give them unnecessary ammunition, recognizing that they don't really need ammunition anyway because they're just going to make stuff up. That was one question. How do we keep from fizzling out? I think that for me, part of the burnout comes from that a lot of activists I know experience comes from doing actions that you know are actually that you're going to lose. And I think that one way we can stop the fizzling is to actually start to gain some successes and to look at groups and people who inspire us and to build on what they're doing. And this can be in above ground means, it can be in below ground means, it doesn't really matter in terms of it still being inspiring. I mean, I have a good friend who has argued cases before the California State Supreme Court. She's an attorney, and she's protected a lot of land, and getting victories, you know, inspires everybody to keep fighting. And at the same time, if we go underground, there's the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta has, through sabotage and bombing, been able to reduce oil output in the Niger Delta by up to 30%. And they've done this with fewer resources than most individuals in the U.S. or the U.K. would have, you know, as a group. And so the way we keep from fizzling, and part of the way we keep from fizzling also, is I think we need to develop strategies. That there were some things that the weather people did that were very, very good, and there were some things that the weather people did that were not so great. And they themselves acknowledged they didn't really have a strategy. And I think before we figure out how we're going to act, I think we need to figure out strategies. And before we figure out strategies, we have to figure out what we want. And, I mean, this is just basic. They do this at West Point. They do this in military academies all over the world. They do this at the Pentagon. It's like, okay, first, what are our objectives? And second, what are the strategies we need to get there? And third, what are the tactics we're going to use to implement those strategies? And I think part of the problem with the environmental movement in general is that I don't think a lot of people really know what they want. I don't think we've set out. We're so busy fighting fires. We're so busy trying to stop this highway from going in or trying to protect this piece of ground or trying to do whatever. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. It's really important, and all that work is absolutely necessary. But we're all so busy doing that we don't have time to sit back and strategize about what we want on a larger scale. And then one more thing about that I just want to say, and this is kind of off topic, but it's sort of on topic too, that part of the reason we're fighting fires so much is because there's so few of us who are actually doing the work. And if there were more people, there would be more time for, you know, some people to be doing the work of protecting this pond and more people to be doing the work of strategizing, et cetera. And a great example of part of the problem that we face is, and I tell this story a lot, I live in Northern California, and in California you can legally grow small amounts of marijuana for medicinal purposes. And the amount of marijuana you can grow is determined by the county that you live in. Some really conservative counties only allow you to have 6 plants at a time, and some counties that, like Humboldt County, one county south of here, you're allowed to have a lot more. I don't know how many. And anyway, the county where I live, Del Norte, allowed you to have 99 plants at any time for personal medicinal consumption. And there were some people who thought that that was excessive, and so the police, board of supervisors, and board of supervisors, the governing council for the county, and churches wanted to reduce it. And so the board of supervisors were going to reduce it from 99 to 6. And it was actually pretty cool. I didn't go. But it was a great example of participatory democracy in action, how it's supposed to work. The place was so packed with angry potheads. And, well, I shouldn't say that. That's not very nice. The place was so packed with people who use marijuana, many of them for medicinal use, many of them very, very sick, who actually use it as a medicine, and that's great. And then also some just straight potheads. But anyway, there were so many people angry at what the Board of Supervisors was going to do that had the Board of Supervisors reduced the number from 99 to 6, they wouldn't have been able to get out of there. And that's how participatory democracy is supposed to work, is when the Board of Supervisors or county commissioners or whatever they are, the mayor, whatever, when they try to make it so a Walmart can come in or so that the fracking can happen, people are supposed to be so outraged that they all come and actually do something. And it was great because the Board of Supervisors was not able to put this into law. That's the good news. The bad news is that when the Board of Supervisors wants to do something terrible about salmon or about off-road vehicles or whatever, there's only three people show up, and they're the same three people. And I wish that people loved salmon the way they love pot. And my point in saying all of this is that one of the things we need to do to build a movement, obviously, is we need to be recruiting as much as we can. And recruiting recruiting good people, recruiting people who are very serious about this and will stay committed. You know, I used to teach I used to teach at a prison, and I would, when I would go in to teach creative writing, oftentimes I'd be walking past these yards, and I would, there'd be concrete wall between me and the people, but I could hear the people inside doing calisthenics or doing various exercises as a group. And I might go in and teach for a couple hours. I come back out, and they're still doing calisthenics. And I was like, who are these people? And the other prisoners would tell me, those are gang members. And they're really, really dedicated. And I'm not suggesting that we form gangs. We're not saying that at all. But there's that level of dedication that those people had, that the gang members had, that was really impressive. And so when I say recruit, what I'm saying is we need to recruit people who are really serious, and by serious, that doesn't mean they're going to pick up guns. By serious, that means they're going to commit to do actions, because the big distinction is not between those who believe in militant resistance and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. And so your work with filmmaking and speaking is really important. I mean, just like I consider my work to be important in terms of recruitment and in terms of helping to build a movement. We need to build a movement, we need to figure out what we want to do with it, and then we need to put it into action.
Yeah, I agree. For me, I guess it's just disheartening at times when I make my films, I do my things, I organize big meetups, and I try and do this thing called the Love Police Academy, where maybe sometimes up to 500 people will turn up, and it's meant to be a kind of a circle where everyone can discuss things. But there is a danger, I think, and I guess this goes through every single sphere of being active in any way, whether you're a businessman or a communist or whatever, that people then suddenly start looking for heroes. And they go, Derek's writing his books, or Charlie's making his films, I can sit back. These guys are being covered. And I find that this a very, very big danger. But coming back to your book, Derek, I just to let you know, Endgame. I had about maybe 300 pages left of volume 2 when I got arrested for words before the royal wedding here in London, and I got thrown in jail for 24 hours for saying that I maybe, with a bunch of friends, maybe wanted to disrupt it using megaphones. And I got thrown in jail for conspiracy to cause a public nuisance. Anyway, very quick tangent. It's good. It shows that the government is scared of us, and that's a very good thing. It's the way it should be. But, no, I was in jail for 24 hours, and I was reading your book going, I'll finish this in jail, and the wonderful irony that I'm actually reading something very good and it's very quiet. But for the last 5 years or so, my favorite film has been a German film called The Lives of Others, Das Leben der Anderen. And I was like, I always wondered what that means. And the film's about a kind of a Stasi captain who gets assigned to look at the lives of other people. But you put it at the preface of Pacifism Part 2 on page 699, the full quote by Frederick Douglass. And he ends, I'm not going to read the whole thing out, but if we ever get free from the oppressions and wrongs heaped upon us, we must pay for their removal. We must do this by labor, by suffering, by sacrifice, and if needs be, by our lives and the lives of others. So that's where that quote comes from, and thank you very much, Derek, for giving me that. But what I'm trying to say by reading this out is that, for me, I think the only way change will come will be through a kind of osmosis of the way we feel, you and I, and the way many people who agree with us feel, into the general mainstream. And I've spent 2 years now going to protests and waving banners and megaphoning and so forth. And has the world improved? I don't know. But I just feel that I really don't know until we do pick up guns and start organizing underground, which is very difficult now with the internet and surveillance and DNA, and I'm on the DNA database. But it seems that we just need to try and inspire, I guess, other writers or other filmmakers to just understand the absolute severity of the situation. And in part one, I think, in volume one of your book, you talk about how sometimes these New Age spiritual movements, such as the New Age interdimensional spirits or the Buddhist traditional route, can sometimes lead to nihilism. And it creates behavior rationalization where people go, oh, well, there's no more salmon, there's no more fish in the oceans, the Amazon's being chopped down, the country the size of Wales every year. But it's okay, it's all an illusion. And like you, Derek, I want to grab these people, slap them across the face, and say, look, illusion or not, then we might as well do something about it. And it's just, I get increasingly frustrated. But one thing I'm glad you mentioned the IRA bombing earlier. I don't know the exact details of that one. But it does seem that we are truly in a propaganda battle. And I think we just need to somehow make activism fun, sexy, exciting, like really almost hip compared to just kind of gross indulgence and self-satisfying capitalism.
Well, sorry.
Go ahead.
Mine's real short, actually. Apparently the Cuban dictator originally started his revolution with many dances and so on and so forth, and that was just kind of something that I had tried just last weekend and got like 50 people out to a fundraiser. It was a small start, but you know, it was an attempt of doing something, so I'll leave it at that.
I think that you know, I think it's really true that we need it all, and we need all approaches. And I say this all the time, and I really believe it. And having said that, I'm not sure that my approach is to attempt to make activism sexy or fun. And can you read, if you have it in front of you, can you read the end of that Frederick Douglass quote again?
Yeah, sure. One moment. We got here. If we ever get free from the oppressions and wrongs heaped upon us, we must pay for their removal. We must do this by labor, by suffering, by sacrifice, and if needs be, by our lives and the lives of others.
Yeah, I find that line extremely inspiring. And it frankly doesn't sound very sexy or fun to me. And a lot of the activism, I mean, it's weird because, yeah, I really enjoy, I mean, I love writing. I totally get off on writing. And we need to find what we get off on. And at the same time, I'm not demeaning the notion of making activism sexy and fun, and I think that that's that's a fine approach for you to take, but my approach really, or and my approach, I think they're complementary, is to talk about the seriousness of the situation. It's like I was doing, I did a benefit several years ago for an environmental organization. And I drove a couple hours over. It was about a 2.5-hour drive to where I did the benefit. And on the way, there'd been a traffic accident. And so I was stuck in, it was way out in the forest and you can't get past. And so it took me like 5 hours to get there or something. So it was a long drive over and it was going to be a long drive home. And my talk is normally pretty long and about maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours to more. And I was about a half hour into my talk, and this one of the people that I was doing the benefit for came up and said, so can you stop your talk now because we want to dance? And what I said was, no, actually, I drove a long ways here. We're going to do the whole talk. But what I wish I would have said is, you know, there's Emma Goldman's line about if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. I want to turn that on its head and say, if I can't have a revolution, I don't want to dance. And there's one thing I wanted to say. Another thing I wanted to say is that I think that the whole osmosis idea is one of the approaches to take. And I think an approach that actually, once again, interests me a little bit more is that I don't think that social change comes primarily through the changing of hearts and minds. I think that social change comes through the changing of the material conditions and political conditions. And so I think that I'm not interested in trying to get human supremacists to not be human supremacists, because one of the fundamental premises of Endgame is that there won't be a voluntary transformation. And instead, we'll need to fight for it, and we will need to destroy the capacity of the rich to steal from the poor and to destroy the capacity of the powerful to kill the planet. And that doesn't – I love this line. I don't remember if it was Noam Chomsky or Howard Zinn, but one of them said that he's not interested – I know you weren't talking about this. I'm just sort of riffing on a different direction. He said that he doesn't believe in speaking truth to power because the people in power already understand what's going on anyway, and they don't care. What he's interested in is speaking truth about power, which is what you're doing as well, speaking truth about power and then helping people to resist that. And I want to say another thing about what you said about organizing under the whole surveillance state, which is so true and so important. But there's this thing I always think about, which was said by the head of South African security, isn't that a nice euphemism, during apartheid. He said that the thing they were most afraid of with the ANC was not its sabotage or even its violence, as it was the possibility that it would convince the mass of South Africans to not respect law and order as such. Because no security force in the world, he said, could stand up to an entire population that no longer believes in the legitimacy of the government. So I think that we can combine the approaches where you have auxiliaries who could even be in it for, you know, the fun, who just show up, are extra bodies at a protest. And then in addition, I think you have the dead serious organizers and cadres who this is their life. And it's like, you know, I really like the movie Norma Rae. I just love the organizer character in there who comes to this community, and he's just, you know, he's really, really dedicated. And it's just, I think a really wonderful character. And I am so inspired by the people who are very, very serious about resistance. And I want to mention one more thing, which is one of my heroes is Dar Jamail, and one of the reasons he's one of my heroes is because he was just this normal guy living up in Alaska, and he didn't like what the U.S. – he didn't like the corporate coverage, the media coverage of the invasion of – most recent U.S. invasion of Iraq. And so instead of just complaining about it, which is what most of us, myself included, do most of the time, he went over and he fixed it himself. He said, okay, I'm going to do better coverage. And I love that. I love the notion of finding a problem and then solving it. Frankly, it's what I did, that there was a hole in environmental discourse. I didn't see any militant environmental discourse. I didn't see any discourse that discussed that the dominant culture, any discourse in environmentalism that discusses that the dominant culture has a death urge. It's like, okay, instead of complaining, instead of writing nasty screeds about all the other books being insufficient, I'll just write my own damn book. And I love that that's what the both of you are doing, too, is you're finding some holes in discourse and you're filling them. And I think that that's really crucial. That's all. I'm just rambling.
No, thank you. I really appreciate that. As a matter of fact, if you don't mind, I know your time's almost up, and I have one more person that's actually holding on the line who's been very patient. I'd like to offer him a chance to ask you a question, if that's okay.
Great.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Ken?
Hey, guys, I want to thank you guys both for coming on the show and talking today. I've been looking forward to it. My internet went out, and I had to jump on my phone to listen to it. I've missed about 15 minutes, so I'm going to have to listen to it later. But as well as Kevin here, I'm also a radio show host and a filmmaker. And, you know, I've been doing this for so long now, and just hearing you guys talk about it, and that idea that, you know, you wake up and you say, hey, am I going to write a book or am I going to blow up a dam today? I really feel you on that. It seems like we've been at this for so long, really since if you want to go back all the way to Socrates, at the very least, you know, we've been trying to wake people up, and it gets to the point where it's like, how much more is there that we can actually do? And I think you guys bring up some really good points, and I wanted to share with you that I feel you there. You know, it sometimes it seems like it's just like one big circle jerk going on. We're doing, you know, just, hey, we're fighting the man, aren't we, you know? And I don't know, I just wanted to share that sentiment with you guys. That's all. I didn't really have a question, but I just wanted to share that with you guys.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, thank you for that.
It was real quick. He and I have done just a couple of shows together as well. He has his own as well, and he also helps bring out a lot of really great conversation. One of the more recent ones was even about like Cascadia Now, which is like about like three states, like two from America and one from Canada, like flat out seceding from their unions and creating their own state.
Yeah, Vermont's thinking about that too. Thinking there's been some rumblings on that. And interestingly enough, in both of those cases, it's for you know, semi-right reasons, as opposed to Texas has been thinking about seceding because they're, you know, because they're right-wing assholes. So they've been thinking, it's like, yeah, fine, go away. I think that he raises a really important point, too, about it's really hard. You know, we do this work, and things continue to get worse and worse and worse. And every activist I know faces this constantly. I remember an activist saying to me 15 years ago, she said, sometimes the only things that keep her going are sorrow and rage. And it's like, yeah, well, as long as I keep you going, that's great. I mean, it's not great, but it's, I understand. And I was communicating with a friend of mine the other day about how, you know, the world is getting so much worse so quickly that, I mean, sometimes it's you know, I've been doing this work forever. I'm a long time veteran, and I'm not going to quit. I'm in this to the end, and I'm writing a new book right now. And nonetheless, it's just the despair is really, really overwhelming. And the only good thing,
Sorry,
the economy is collapsing, and it's really a race as to whether the economy of the world collapses faster. And so we can do what we can to kick the economy down faster. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I just want to give you guys some optimism and maybe give myself some optimism. I think the things we say to others are primarily directed at ourselves. But when I started out with making my films, I used to film myself walk up to senior policemen and tell them to brace themselves because revolution would be coming to Great Britain. And not only would they laugh at me, my viewers would laugh at me and call me crazy. And then you fast forward 18 months, and all around the Arab world, big uprisings are kind of changing the fabric of their society to different extents. And just today, there's the biggest, most violent fight of young, unemployed students and normal people in Athens and Greece, which I believe will probably create a mass resignation in that government, telling the IMF to fuck off, telling the World Bank to fuck off, and the best thing is telling the European Union to stick it. People are sick of superstates. I mean, this is going to spread to Spain, it's going to spread to Portugal and Italy, and we're seeing this now in Ireland again now. The people are saying, enough is enough. Like, the generalized public, and I hate to say this, but they're not the world's most academic or intellectual bunch. They will pretty much follow whichever brightest light is jingled in front of them. But they're starting to connect the crash of 2008 to the people who are still very rich. And you know, the last year, the number of billionaires on Earth increased by 30%. I mean, what the fuck is going on? And when the general masses, when the normal man on the street has nothing left to lose because he's got no money, he's got no job, his kids are hungry, then we will see change. But what I wanted to say in terms of great optimism is that I feel this abusive power structure, this toxic mimicry of parenthood named the government, is showing, it's revealing its own face. I mean, now with YouTube and the internet, instantly, whenever the government or the police do something very bad, everyone sees it. And the more people that sees it, and especially the mothers of children who get sent to go and get their legs blown off for an oil company, when the middle classes start saying enough is enough, then it will change. So people who used to laugh at me 18 months ago by saying revolution would come, I hope they come and see what happens in London after tomorrow when 500,000 people, alongside the general strike, which the main trade union has organized, will shut down London. And we will show this government that, you know, the general masses, the non-intellectual, the non-academic, are starting to get it.
Well, that's great. And that seems like a great note to end on. It's a wonderful note. Thank you so much for saying that. And thank you both for your work.
Thanks, Derek.
Thank you for being an inspiration as well. Please continue. Like, if there's anything I'd like to like offer you before you go, it's just appreciation for all the work that you've done, and just please continue to do it, because I know more people need to hear it. And I won't say anything about your little essay that you sent to me, but I really appreciated that, and it really meant a lot to me. So I just wanted to say that as well, and I'm looking forward to that getting out there as well, because that was, I think that's really important information for you specifically, of all people, to say. So
thank you for saying that. And let's do this again sometime.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and in the meantime, maybe I'll see you both on the barricades.
Yeah, see you out there.
Yeah, see ya. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Bye.
Okay, are you still with me there?
I am. How much longer do we have, or should we wrap things up?
If you don't mind, I'd like to take a few more moments, just because I haven't had really much chance to speak with you as well. We've been dedicating our time to Derek, even just a few more moments, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. My girlfriend just got back from holiday, so I'll have to be maybe 10 more minutes, and then I better give her some loving kindness TM.
I completely understand. My wife just went away as well for a working vacation also. I also just wish to like really offer you my thanks as well. I mean, seeing those videos in the beginning when I first started like about a year and a half ago online, I saw like you and Danny Shine out there, and these things really sparked something in me, made me want to go out and like get off my couch and go do something as well. And I met up with some people in like the End the Fed movement, and they worked with another group that had to do with giving out jury information so that people in America know that like a jury basically has the right to end the whatever law is going on at the moment and say, no, you're free to go. Have a nice one. And working with these, with that group, we almost formed like a camera militia out of your Love Police idea. And I've actually seen it blossom into like three other groups. There's like three other dudes out there kind of doing the same thing with their own megaphone, and also going to like really prominent locations like either the Federal Reserve or out in the middle of the street. And you've kind of re-sparked a little bit of that independence from back when we first like started this country in being against your country. It's kind of funny that like now someone like you has actually given such a rekindling of that independence thought and liberty notions to bring them to the foreground. And you deserve some, if not recognition, at least acknowledgement on just the fact that your ideas are getting out there and as well. And please continue to do it. I mean, it's a great thing that you're doing, getting all this information out to people and helping other protesters feel like they can be free as well. I mean, other people don't really always see their own light until they see it reflected in someone else. Are you still with me, Charles?
Sorry, I had my microphone muted there. Sorry, while I was listening to you. It really means a lot to hear you say that, and I'm really touched by it. And thank you. And I guess it shows I'm doing my job properly if people say that. And I get mail from people who say similar things that you say. And so I feel my work is important. And I promise you I will carry on. I will always put a very an anarchic and a resistance edge to my filmmaking, because I think that's what the world needs right now. And the work I do is very much it's as much personal to me, and doing what I feel is right for me as it is for everyone else. And I'm just very lucky that what I feel is right for me in terms of being independent and thinking for yourself is also what it seems that the world needs. And coming back to the earlier videos with Danny, what we set out to do was just the only mission statement was to lower fear and raise love. But what I found from rewatching the films and editing them was the way we freed people from the shackles in their brain was if you show them that all authority is absurd and ridiculous and quite funny, then they'll actually start to question other hierarchies in their lives. And once you show that, you know, the kind of arbitrary laws of the state or the police are ridiculous and very funny, and that people get thrown in jail for using megaphone. And the megaphone is the 21st century assault rifle, I think. And it's propaganda pure, because you're never going to hurt someone or kill someone, an innocent bystander, with a megaphone. At the very worst, you'll offend them and they'll report you to the police and you get thrown in jail for saying something outrageous. But yeah, I mean, I, like Derek, I always ask myself, why don't I take it to the next level? Why don't I start organizing? I guess it's fear of infiltration, that if I had a kind of organized movement, there would be a very strong government desire to infiltrate it. I can see how it's very difficult to get even three people to agree on something, and I'd hate for it to descend into politics and infighting if we had, say, 100 people trying to organize something. And someone asked me the other day, they said, would you like to be king of the world or dictator of the world? And I said, no way. I want to be a freelance advisor for the world with the opportunity to walk away at any moment. And so the main part of my work is to show people just how ugly the will to power, the desire for power can make things. And if people have no desire for power over others, if they have anarchy in their heart, if they are spiritual anarchists, then I think they will shine and other people will appreciate it a lot. And I I will always stick to my anarchy. And it's a reflection of two things. I guess it's firstly a desire for how I wish the world to be in the future, when everyone is of a sentient level where we don't need hierarchies. But it's also, I think, a subconscious reflection of how I think the world in a way truly is. I don't think anyone is actually in charge. I think it's one giant chaotic system, but what is actually in charge is ignorance and hate and stupidity. And those are our biggest enemies, I think, because if we, for example, I don't know, managed to stop the chief executive officer of BP from doing his job through some scandal, he would get replaced by the next robot drone. But if we can show people just how power and things are ridiculous and so forth, then they will kind of not want to buy shares in BP. Oh yeah, one last thing. I forgot to mention this to Derek, which once we were talking about things to do. I'm a big believer in the idea that if you're going to pay tax, it should be voluntary taxation. That unless taxation is voluntary, you are a slave to the government. If they will take it without any choice, for example, they invaded Iraq and Afghanistan and now they're bombing the shit out of Libya, but taxation has to be voluntary, because then if you withhold your tax, your government needs to start doing what the people want. But it's much more complicated than that, because as we both know, 70% of the people actually support warfare, and they're so fucked up from their own childhood that they want blood and anger and gore and death. And Derek talks about this in his book very openly, about abusive relationships and bad parenting and how that does lead to the kind of mirrors of that throughout life. So, no, man, thanks for the kind words. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I do you have any last piece of advice on people to just, I guess, learn to, I don't know. I don't want to, like, throw out a giant monologue here, but it's very important for me to hear that other people who are in their positions of quote-unquote power, because of that when the grassroots arise, sometimes some sprouts come up really high, and you seem to be one of them, and you keep your ego at a minimum for the most part, I've noticed, and I think you should be honored for that as well. But I guess the point I'm really trying to get at is there anything that you specifically believe that we can do to help people start becoming more leaders of themselves, so that they have the ability to then stand up for doing what is right? I mean, I think a lot of people are so afraid to even be a leader that they just wind up following all the time. And how do we give them that courage to stand up and do it themselves?
Sure. No, that's a very, very good question. And luckily I've got an answer, which is verifiable, because I put it all on the internet. It makes me chuckle, because you've just raised something in my head, which is quite funny. That when I started doing Love Police, and I still get these rumors now, many people watch the videos and say, oh my God, how does he do that? He must be an agent. He must be MI5 or MI6 or Illuminati or CIA. Look at what he does, and so forth. And what people are mistaking there is, what people need to realize, and this is my inspiration, this is the answer, is that I got ejected from the finance world and was like, fuck, what am I going to do with my life? And I'd never made a film before. I'd never really put stuff on YouTube except maybe a couple of old clips from my camera phone. And I just went out there one day, bought a camera, met Danny, and started doing it. And I think ideas are very cheap in this world, and it's actually doing it, which is really difficult. I remember 2 years ago, I was an absolute nobody. Nobody in the resistance or the truth movement or whatever we call it knew who I was. And I just started doing it, and I was much more of the thought that content is more important than post-production. So yeah, I'm not the world's greatest editor, but I think the footage speaks for itself. So just start doing it. That's the only thing that's stopping you achieving your dreams, is that kind of not doing it. I know it sounds so simplistic and so simple, but just do it. Just go out there and start doing what feels right to you, and then that will evolve and spawn other things. And I'm at the point now, 2 years later, where, yeah, like, as you say, I'm very lucky. I have a profile. I can put ideas out there, and it'll be watched by many people, many more than when I started. And I just want to let all the listeners know that what's key here is tuning to your own heart and putting your energy out there hard. It doesn't need to be by a camera. It doesn't need to be by being a writer like Derek. You don't need to be good on the megaphone. But every single person is a human being and is able to look at the world and say, that's fucked, this is fucked, that there is fucked, and you can do something about it. So we don't need another love police. Well, I'd love everyone to be able to do this, but you don't need to mimic what I do. Just find out what it is you do. And remember, this is very important, that I, for the first 6 months of doing Love Police, it was very small. I only had a couple thousand subscribers. But I didn't give up hope because I knew it was right for me. So if you don't get recognition, if you don't basically create a wave straight away, keep at it. It's taken me 2 years to turn my life around from office obedient drone working in a high-rise glass and metal cage to being a free human being, well, as much as I can be, that doesn't pay tax, that doesn't vote, that doesn't, you know, obey others. So remember, you can't change your life overnight. Well, you can, but what I'm trying to say is, if you're going to change your life and put it on a different path, it takes a bit of time. So don't, as they say, good things come to those who wait. So patience, my friend, is a virtue.
Yeah. It's kind of like in Derek's book where he talks actually about how there's a we need a 12-step program for civilization.
Yeah.
But again, yeah, I don't want to hold you up. Please give Silky a hug for me. You guys are great. Keep up the great work, and thank you so much for coming on my little show. I really appreciate it, man.
No, thank you so much. Please send me the link or the MP3, and I'll make sure it goes out to as many people as possible as well.
Sure. It might take about an hour, but yeah, I'll get it out to you, man.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Have fun.
See you. Cheers.